The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is David Dino. Let's go ahead and get started here. I do have a handout in addition to the outline that's in your conference program. It starts on page 126. I do have a handout here with some of the key, a few of the key quotes that we'll be talking through today. So if we can just that'd be great. Yeah, just kind of divide it and split, and then maybe put them in the back as people come in, so that if they want to, I think we should have plenty of copies, so there should be plenty to go around. I'm going to just go ahead and start and introduce this a little bit. This talk grew out of some of my thinking about what it means to do. I'll say that again since I was turned around. This talk grew out of some of my thinking about what it means to think philosophically as a Christian. My academic training is in philosophy of education and philosophy, my PhD in philosophy. And so over the years, I've thought a lot about what the nature of philosophy is. Two characteristics that historically have defined philosophy, and this is not a talk about philosophy, this is the introduction, I'm explaining this, that have been attributed to the discipline of philosophy historically are that it begins with wonder and that its goal is wisdom. And so the doing of philosophy historically has been understood by many thinkers as a journey from wonder toward wisdom. And what I came to realize as I thought about this is that this movement from wonder toward wisdom, in fact, characterizes not just the discipline of philosophy in the sense of the narrow discipline that it has become today within the university, the academy, but rather the enterprise of learning writ large. And so what I'm going to do today is I'm going to examine the enterprise of learning as wonder toward wisdom. And we're going to do this by looking at some texts and some different thinkers' understandings about the way that the nature of philosophy has often been understood. So I say this introductorily just to be clear that while I'm going to use the term philosophy quite often today, I want to be clear that what we're really talking about is learning in general. And I think that this talk and this topic, this conception of learning as wonder toward wisdom, is just as relevant and applicable whether you're teaching math or science or kindergarten or 12th grade or literature or theology or philosophy or whatever. Okay, I think that this applies across the board. So just as a historical caveat before we jump into this, in terms of background and defining some of our key terms, if you go back in history, this is sort of a preview justification for why I feel legitimate in doing this. If you go back in history, you find that the term philosophy has been understood for centuries in much broader terms than we think of it today in contemporary academic contexts. So, for example, oftentimes the discipline of philosophy was divided into three kinds of philosophy. You had divine philosophy, which was the study of the gods. Today we would call that something like theology. You have natural philosophy, which was the study of the natural world. We would call that science. And you had moral philosophy, the study of right and wrong, which we would today call ethics. So divine philosophy, moral philosophy, natural philosophy. Sometimes instead of that threefold distinction, it was a twofold distinction that was made by Boethius, for example, in a commentary on Porphyry between practical philosophy and theoretical philosophy or speculative or contemplative philosophy. And again, the practical side includes moral philosophy, sort of how we should live kinds of questions. The theoretical or speculative side includes metaphysics, theology, natural science, things like that. Now, I'm not particularly concerned about the taxonomy that we use. Okay, that's not really the point. My point is just simply this. Throughout most of history, the concept of scientist, as we think of it, simply didn't exist. And the concept of philosophy or philosopher was much broader than we typically think of it today. Throughout the history of the Western tradition, there's a long line, in fact, of talking about science and philosophy interchangeably Okay? There's an interesting passage in Plato's Timaeus in which he says, quote, our ability to see the periods of day and night, of months and years, of equinoxes and solstices has led to the invention of number and has given us the idea of time and opened the path of inquiry into the nature of the universe. Well, that sounds pretty math science-y, right? And the very next sentence is, these pursuits have given us philosophy, a gift from the gods to the human race. Okay, so you see this this close link. The break between philosophy and science really didn't start until the Scientific Revolution, and really came to the fore in the 19th century. In 1651, for example, Thomas Hobbes published The Leviathan. At one point in Part 1, Chapter 10, he treats science and philosophy as total synonyms. Okay, they're synonymous terms. And it wasn't until an article was published in 1834 in the Quarterly Review that the term scientist first ever appeared in print, okay, in the way that we think of it today. Up until the 19th century, people who we would call scientists simply considered themselves to be natural philosophers, okay? So again, I'm belaboring this point a little bit before we jump into the content of this talk, because I want to make really clear to everyone here that what I have to say today about the enterprise of learning as a journey from wonder toward wisdom is applicable to all of us and encompasses all of our disciplines, even though I will be talking and citing sources who talk about philosophy, okay? So I want us all, you can apply this to whatever discipline you teach or whatever grade level you teach. Okay, so before we actually jump into the nature of wonder, what we're going to do here is look at the nature of wonder, examine sort of wonder, what is wonder, how does that work at the beginning of learning, the enterprise of learning, and then what does it mean to say that the goal of all of this is wisdom, how do we understand that, and then finally look at this from an explicitly Christian perspective. Within Christian schools, classical Christian schools, how does this mean in terms of how we understand student formation and what the education that we're providing is all about? So, before we get into that, again, the outline is on page 126 of your conference book, and the handout with the quotes are at the back. If anybody still needs that, I think people are getting it as they come in, so you can take a look at that as well. One other thing I did just want to mention, all of you received a copy of this book on John Milton, that was written by Grant Horner in your bag. This is part of a series that I'm editing for Classical Academic Press. We have a number of other volumes as well that may be very helpful, hopefully are helpful. I wrote a volume on Plato, the philosopher, not the stuff you work with in, at a play table. I wrote this volume, and Lou Marcos, who's here this weekend also, or this week also, is giving a talk later this afternoon. He's a fantastic scholar and thinker and speaker. If you haven't seen him, he's down at HBU. Lou Marcos wrote a book on C.S. Lewis as well. These are available downstairs at Classical Academic Press's bookstore, so if you want to, at their table, so please feel free to stop by and pick those up. And this is a series that we're developing, and more books are in the works also. We've got one on Aristotle, Cicero, Augustine, Comenius, and then a long that are currently underway, and then a long list of others that we want to add. And the goal of this is to have academically credentialed scholars and thinkers writing concise, accessible summaries of these thinkers' philosophies of education, so that you, as a teacher, or even your students, can look up and read a short volume on, say, C.S. Lewis that's 50 pages long, and it gives you sort of overview of how Lewis understood education, or the same with Plato or Milton or whomever. So I would encourage you to take a look at those downstairs. Finally, we're supposed to go until 12:10, I believe. If possible, I'd like to end a little early just to give you all a jump on lunch. So I'm going to move quickly. This might be actually, some psychologist could probably make a case for this. When I was a little kid, our church had potlucks all the time, and I always wanted to be first in line. It was like a big deal to me as a small child to be first in line. So, the point of that was I'm going to move quickly, and try to jam a lot into this next 45 minutes, but we'll try to get out, at or before the designated time. Okay, so as I said, what we're going to do is look first at the nature of wonder, and then examine, you know, that's where it starts and where learning starts, and then look at where it's going in terms of the enterprise of learning as being directed toward wisdom, and then examine finally what all this means for us from an explicitly Christian perspective. So, starting with wonder. From the ancient Greeks onward, it's been understood that the beginning of philosophy is wonder. Let me just give you a couple of examples. This is quote number one on your sheet there. In the Theaetetus, Plato says, well, Socrates says, the character, I often wonder, like mad, what these things can mean. Sometimes when I'm looking at them, I begin to feel quite giddy. And, Theaetetus says that. And Socrates responds by saying, this is an experience which is characteristic of a philosopher, this wondering. This is where philosophy begins and nowhere else. So this is the exclusive source from which this kind of thinking begins and is the sense of wonder. Quote number two, Aristotle in the Metaphysics similarly writes, quote, it is owing to their wonder that men both now begin and at first began to philosophize, end quote. So throughout history, many thinkers have similarly claimed that the beginning of philosophy is wonder. James Shaw, in his book, The Life of the Mind, and this quote is not on there, but if you're looking for good books, because you don't have any to read, you haven't found any at this conference worth buying and reading, I would recommend James Shaw's book, The Life of the Mind. He writes this, he says, quote, no one can be a potential philosopher unless something moves him to wonder, unless he is struck by the being of something, not himself. End quote. Okay, so what does it mean to wonder or to marvel at something? Let's start there. Well, there are, I think, two aspects of it, okay? And you see this on the outline, there are two aspects of it. The first aspect has two aspects. See how philosophical this is? The first aspect has two aspects. So the first aspect of what it means to wonder has this twofold positive and negative. It's a recognition that one doesn't know something, and that's coupled with a curiosity to know it. So there's simultaneously a negative and a positive aspect. When you marvel or wonder at something, you recognize that you don't fully know or understand it, but you're also searching for its truth. You desire to understand it or know it, right? So Joseph Pieper, there's another book I would highly recommend if you haven't read Leisure at the Basis of Culture. It often comes in, that's sort of a must-read in my world. Leisure at the Basis of Culture by Joseph Pieper, and it often comes published with Philosophical Act, which is a short essay that he wrote also. And he wrote this in the Philosophical Act. Quote, it is only someone who does not yet know fully who wonders. Okay, end quote. I love there the sense of lack and anticipation. Let me say that again. It is only someone who does not yet know who fully wonders. It's not a resigned, I don't know. Oh well, big deal, right? It's a, I don't know yet. I recognize my ignorance, but I also have this desire to learn. Aquinas, similarly, in the Summa, defines wonder as the desiderium sciendi, the longing or the desire to know, the longing for knowledge. That's what wonder is. Supposedly, the very term philosopher, which as you all know means what? Lover of wisdom, etymologically. This was coined by Pythagoras in explicit contrast to the term sophos. Okay? So the sophists claimed to be wise, right? They're the wise ones. The philosophers, humbly, of course, because philosophers are always humble, right? The philosophers humbly said, we're not the wise ones. We are lovers of wisdom. We recognize that we don't have it yet, but we're looking for it. So that's the sense of wonder, that the dual sense of not having it, but also longing for it. And Shaw writes, James Shaw, in The Life of the Mind, says this, quote, please God that we all find ourselves in this condition of those who know that they do not know. I love such students, such potential philosophers, as I call them, end quote. And so that's the first aspect of what it means to wonder, this dual recognition that you don't know something and that you also want to know it. The second thing about wonder or marvel is that it often, though not always, but it often involves a kind of simplicity. So if you look at quote number three there, Pieper says in the Philosophical Act this: to perceive all that is unusual and exceptional, all that is wonderful in the midst of the ordinary things of everyday life, that, he says, is the beginning of philosophy. So to wonder means to look at something that others take for granted and realize that there's a deeper meaning to it that we don't fully understand. And for centuries, thinkers, especially philosophers, have been making people annoyed and angry by doing this. Okay, so let me give you a couple of examples. In Plato's Dialogues, we'll go to Plato first. In the Dialogues, he'll repeatedly do things, right? So Socrates will go up to someone and say, "Hey, do you know what justice is? Because I don't know." So he says, "Well, of course I know what justice is. Everybody knows what justice is. Well, what is it?" Okay, and then, you know, like 400 pages later, or 10 or whatever, the person goes, "I don't know. You've got me. Nobody knows what justice is." Okay. Now, the point here is not that we're leading towards some sort of skepticism. Okay, but the point is that we use terms or we see things around us every day that we often take for granted. Right? We all use words like truth and justice, but the reality of the matter is those fairly ordinary terms are actually quite complex. And we really, probably most of us in this room, don't have a very full understanding of them. Okay? So part of the sense of wonder or marvel is this sense of simplicity, right? That you look at something that everybody sort of just takes for granted, and you marvel at it or wonder at it or see something in it that others don't see. Let me just give you a couple of other examples of this. Another example. All of us know what an equilateral triangle is, right? And so, unless you flunked geometry class back in the day. What's an equilateral triangle? A triangle with equal sides and hence equal angles. This is a trick question. Has anyone ever seen an equilateral triangle? Don't answer. The answer is no, right? You can't. None of us has ever seen one. We can't draw one. If I try to draw an equilateral triangle, right, my lines won't be perfectly straight. And the ink on the page is technically not a line anyway because it has width, which makes it a plane. And technically it has depth because it bled into the paper, which means the ink is really some sort of three-dimensional, you know, polygon. So, it means from the get-go, it's hopeless, right? You can't draw an equilateral triangle. Okay, now, but we all know what it is. Now, that's weird. So this sense of wonder, right, these crazy philosophers marvel at this. And they say some things like, you know, how is it that we all understand something that none of us has ever seen? That's creepy. Where did we get this idea? Do such things as equilateral triangles actually exist? I mean, if not, then why do we talk about them? We all understand them, and they're really useful, by the way. And if so, like, where do they exist? And this is a complicated question, right? And yet in our day-to-day existence, we sort of just, you know, plow through triangles and it's no big deal. Let me give one other example. This is from natural philosophy or science, okay? One final example about this kind of simplistic wonder. Sir Isaac Newton, watched apples falling and started asking deep questions about what is rather an ordinary phenomenon that has been going on, I suppose, since the apple was invented or created. Right? It wasn't invented. It was created. Okay? So now one note here, right? There's this story that Newton discovered gravity, right, because he was sitting under an apple tree and got conked on the head with an apple. It's probably a historical embellishment, but Newton did write throughout his life in multiple places that his thinking about gravity, he did explicitly tie his thinking about gravity back to the experience of watching apples fall. Okay? So there is some ground here. Now, what made Newton different from the, you know, gazillions of people who had watched apples fall before him is that he saw in this very ordinary phenomenon something that he couldn't explain. And he wondered at that. Okay, now, let me just explain why this was so complicated. Aristotle had taught that when a force is constantly applied to an object, that object moves at a constant speed, and that when the force is removed, the object returns to rest. Okay? This makes a lot of sense if you're, you know, pushing chairs across the floor. You push on the chair, it moves. You stop pushing, it stops moving. Okay? Pretty straightforward. So the force applied puts the thing into motion at a constant velocity, and then when the force is removed, the thing stops. Okay, the problem is that explanation doesn't do very well with apples. What's pushing on the apple? Nothing, right? It's just sort of hanging there, and then and it's down on the ground. Like, nothing's pushing on it. And while it's in the process of falling, it's just in midair. There's certainly, it would seem, nothing pushing on it there. Right? So why is it falling? And of course, it's not falling at a constant velocity either. It's accelerating. Weird! So Newton says, why is this the case? Okay, and then went about figuring this out. Which is a rather important discovery, as it were. Okay? The point here is that these are all examples of how we start with a topic that may seem fairly simple. And true inquiry, true learning, one of the key steps in that process is looking at these kinds of topics that seem very simple and marveling at their deep complexity. It's interesting to note that people who do this, people who are filled with this kind of wonder, often seem very naive or childlike. Consider, you know, the erudite professor who gets up and says, after extensive research and profound thought, I have come to the conclusion that I exist. He said, well, thank you for that. You know, why are we paying you for an endowed chair to come up with, truisms like that? We all knew that, right? Or consider a small child who's transfixed by the fact that a helium balloon goes up instead of down. You ever think about that? I mean, that's really creepy. Like, your whole life you watch things fall, and then the first time you ever see a helium balloon and it goes up, you're like, whoa, right? I mean, the child doesn't understand. This is something very, very crazy, right? Almost magical. Now, we have to stop hurrying ourselves and our students through life, and we have to give ourselves and our children time to marvel at these things. Right? Hey, stop looking at balloons. We'll be late to school where you're going to learn a bunch of stuff. Right? These sort of ironies. Children are often the best learners or philosophers because they haven't yet lost this sense of wonder. They're not afraid of acknowledging that they don't know, and they're not afraid often of asking simple questions that everyone else takes for granted. So many, many great discoveries happen because someone just stepped back and asked a very simple question about a very ordinary kind of phenomenon that nobody before had thought to ask. Okay? So let me ask you this. Before we move on to wisdom, when was the last time that you experienced a sense of wonder at something? This kind of naive or childlike simplicity of being awed. One of the most difficult challenges, I think, that we face as educators in our contemporary context is that our students, and in large part we as well, have been drastically dulled in our ability to truly marvel at things and be simply amazed by them. Okay? So in large part, it's due to our immersion in media, which is another talk we won't talk into media bashing now. Okay? I know an art teacher, for example, who gave some senior students, very advanced art students, a little sliver of green bell pepper, right? And said, here, paint this. And the students, it was very, very interesting, actually. The students sort of looked at it and go, you want us to paint a pepper? Like, that's really kind of dumb, right? I mean, that's easy. Like, it's just this little piece of green thing. And the point was, start looking at it. Do you see all the veins? Do you see all the different shades of green that are in this slice of green bell pepper? Right? This is actually a very intricate and complicated thing. And the whole point here was, take something very simple, very mundane, very common, and take the time to wonder at it. Take the time to examine it. Take the time to see the complexities that most of us, on a daily basis, as we take a green pepper out of the refrigerator and chop it up and eat it, or throw it in a stir fry or whatever, don't just skip right over. Okay? In a world of digitally enhanced everything, from pictures of landscapes to music to special effects movies to the bodies of models, and I could go on and on, it is very difficult to maintain a simple sense of wonder and not need continually more sensationalism. Quotation number 4 on your sheet, then, by Joseph Pieper. I love the way that he says this. Quote, our sense of wonder, in the philosophical meaning of the word, is not aroused by enormous, sensational things, though that is what a dulled sensibility requires to provoke it to an experience of wonder. A man who needs the unusual to make him wonder shows that he has lost the capacity to find the true answer to the wonder of being. The itch for sensation is a sure indication of a bourgeois mind and a deadened sense of wonder. End quote. Shaw, this is not on your sheet, but in that book, The Life of the Mind, he similarly writes this, quote, "We live in a world surrounded by noise, by a kind of strident unrest that fills our days and our nights. We have so many things to distract us, even if sometimes we think they might educate us." Ooh. Is there anything in your classroom or in your school or in your life that you think is educating you that in fact is just distracting you? Or filling your life with this strident noise and unrest? Shaw says, "We find the time first by becoming interested, by longing to know," end quote. We could give lots of examples of this, right, in our culture. You don't have to go back very far, in watching MTV videos or action movies to see how quickly, over the past years or a couple of decades, our need for sensationalism has continued to grow, right? Our need to have more and more and more in order to be engaged and to feel a sense of wonder has grown. That's exactly what Pieper's talking about, right? That the man who needs the unusual to wonder, that just shows that we've lost the capacity that we're looking for. Okay, I don't want to go into this in depth, but I just want to point out that whereas throughout much of history, learning has been taken to begin with wonder, during the modern era, this was changed, and learning started to begin with doubt. Just think of Descartes, right, for example. And the dictum that de omnibus dubitandum est, everything must be doubted. So we're going to raise everything to the ground through doubt and then build a foundation. It's highly ironic, I think, that the modern scientific outlook often scorns wonder and instead looks for experimentally verifiable facts, and the mystical, the supernatural, etc., are looked upon as sort of horribly old-fashioned or downright silly. Where, in fact, the irony there is that the history of science, of natural philosophy, is rife with examples of people who had major breakthroughs precisely through engaging in this sense of wonder or marvel at things. Okay, so moving on, that's a little bit about wonder, and like I said, we'll come back to this and look at this biblically and from a Christian perspective in a few minutes. Let's move on and look at the way in which learning is pointed toward wisdom. Okay, philosophy, as we said, is literally the love of wisdom, philia and sophia. It's a philosopher, or through this lens, I would say a learner, is someone whose goal is the attainment of wisdom. So wisdom is the goal or the telos of the entire pursuit. Let me just give a few examples of this historically, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. Go back to Plato again. Everything starts with Plato, as Whitehead so aptly noted. To take this general characterization of the entire Western European European Western tradition is that it is a series of footnotes to Plato, right? So we'll go back to Plato. Incidentally, that quote is found in this really long book that Whitehead wrote, and the place where it's found doesn't really have anything to do with Plato, per se. It's kind of interesting. That quote has been pulled out, and it's quite famous, but if you go back and look in the context, it's kind of an odd, the placement seems odd. It's kind of an aside. So throughout Plato's dialogue, Socrates continually converses with these different interlocutors in order to figure out the nature of various virtues. So in the Euthyphro, it's piety. In the Republic, it's justice. Courage, the nature of virtue itself in the Meno, is the subject of discussion. It has been argued that the starting point for all of Plato's philosophy is a comprehensive search for the nature of virtue. Okay, a number of people have argued this that we could look at. Throughout his works, there is an intimate, and this is where the point here is for us, there's this intimate relationship between virtue and wisdom. In a number of dialogues, Plato seems to be moving toward the view that the essence of each virtue is wisdom. And that is to say, the entire Platonic corpus as a whole can be read as a search for the nature of wisdom. In the Euthydemus, Plato conflates wisdom and virtue. And Socrates argues that all good things are good, well, things like, you know, money, health, good looks, etc., honor, are neither good nor bad in and of themselves, but only good insofar as their use is guided by wisdom. makes a similar point in the Meno. Wisdom, in other words, consists in the ability to use these things virtuously. Okay, so the thing he's searching for is virtue, and virtue is only useful if you know how to use it well, and that requires wisdom. Okay, a similar relationship between wisdom and virtue can be seen in Aristotle. Aristotle draws the distinction between theoretical wisdom and practical wisdom, or phronesis. Theoretical wisdom is this combination of knowledge and intuitive reason into the things that are highest by nature. And practical wisdom, which is learned through practice and the formation of habits, is the ability to apply those general principles to specific cases. So, for example, I might know the general rule that I should love other people, but I need practical wisdom in order to help me know what that means to translate that into action when, you know, a colleague mistreats me, or I hear about a group of people who are suffering somewhere in the world, etc. What does that general rule mean? Well, that requires wisdom, says Aristotle. So practical wisdom and theoretical wisdom are clearly related, and Aristotle says in the Ethics that practical wisdom helps theoretical wisdom come into being by issuing orders. Okay, so I want to make two brief points about the nature of wisdom, which is the goal of all learning, that we see in these two thinkers, okay? In Plato and Aristotle. Number one, wisdom is not merely knowledge. Sophia is not reducible to episteme. Knowing stuff doesn't make you virtuous and wise. In fact, these thinkers argue, it can lead to very pernicious effects. Right? Knowledge, if unhinged from virtue and wisdom, can lead to great evil. Okay? Plato and Aristotle did not completely agree about the relationship between knowing what is virtuous and doing it. They actually disagreed about that. But they both viewed wisdom as something more than knowledge. Okay, and then point number two, which we've already talked about a little bit, is just that wisdom is intimately linked to virtue. Quote number five on your sheet there, Aristotle says, "It is impossible to be practically wise without being good." Okay, so the goal of philosophy, and through that lens, the goal of all learning, necessarily implies a life of virtue. Now, we're going to come back to this in a minute, but think about what that means. If all learning is guided toward wisdom, is directed toward wisdom, and that necessarily involves a life of virtue, that has serious implications for how we understand what our whole enterprise and profession is about. In the Republic, Plato says that the ultimate objective of the philosopher is to know the form of the good. Before we move on, let me just, as an aside, but I think an important one, let me point out that that is a claim you will not hear in contemporary discourse on education almost anywhere except at a classical Christian school conference and a few other very small places. Okay? The machine of education and the machine of educational thought and policy that is dictating all across our country and in many parts of the world, the way that our children are learning and being taught and what teachers understand is their role in the whole, you know, nasty process, is almost devoid of this understanding that the ultimate objective of education is wisdom and virtuous living. That almost all of the discussion on education in contemporary context has to do with the how, with the mechanics. And you can listen to international leaders on education give supposedly, you know, revolutionary talks on how education is going to be bettered across our country and the world. And you will be hard-pressed to find them making much of a teleological claim at all about what the purpose of education is. And if you get something in terms of what's the point, you'll get something like, well, we all need education, obviously, so that, you know, people can go out and make money and produce things for society. And that's a lousy justification that has been excoriated throughout all of history by lots of more people that are way more intelligent than any of us in this room. Okay? But my point is, it's a wasteland because we're not thinking about what is the point of all this. And so I think it's incredibly important for us as Christian classical educators to consider, what does it mean in my second grade classroom, in my science classroom, in my 11th grade humanities classroom, what does it mean for me to be pointing my students in everything we do toward a life of virtue and wisdom? It's very, very, very important. Okay? More to say about that, can't. If you want to hear more about the centrality of virtue in the ancient understanding of education, come to Atlanta next week to SCL. I'm giving a talk on it there. So, okay. One other aside here. Note that if education has wisdom as its telos, as its goal, that cannot be evaluated very accurately by quantitative testing at the end of each step in a child's education. If a school's purpose is to lead students on a quest toward wisdom and virtue, then why in the world would we think that our school's effectiveness at meeting that goal can be judged by some tests that its pubescent high school students take? Right? This is a lifelong quest. A much better measure, though a little bit more difficult to express with a cute bar graph in next year's glossy brochure, is what are those students like in 10 years, or 20 years, or 40 years, or 60 years? What are they like as parents or grandparents? How are they involved in their churches? How do they serve their communities? How have they maintained a lifestyle of learning? How do they show love and compassion to those around them? How do their lives reflect the love of wisdom? Those are the kinds of questions by which a school should evaluate itself. Okay? Wendell Berry has this fantastic little quote, and I don't have it with me exactly, but he says something to the effect of, there never has been, nor ever will be, thank God, a metric by which to measure teacher success. The only way to measure teacher success is by random events that might pop out in the life of a child or grandchild of the student. And he's sort of overstating the case, but the point is you're planting seeds, you're making an investment as an educator into students that is going to bear fruit for decades and generations to come. Like, the measure of the quality of what we're doing cannot be reduced to a multiple choice test that's given at the end of the year or at the end of a 12-year school career. Okay? Now, finally, moving into the last section. Given this picture, what does this mean for us as Christians? Right? How do we engage in the enterprise of learning from a distinctly Christian perspective? It means that we begin our examination of whatever topic we're examining with a sense of wonder and a desire for wisdom that are based on the transcendence of God and the recognition that He is the source of all true wisdom. We begin the enterprise of learning. Okay, and again, I would just want to hammer home, this is just as true in AP calculus as it is in kindergarten. It doesn't matter. We begin this enterprise of learning with wonder at the awesomeness of God and His creation. We recognize that the complexities around us, the complexities of reality, are the result of creative work of God, the awesome Creator God who transcends us in every way. Isaiah 55, 8 and 9 says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, declares the Lord. My ways are not your ways, neither are your ways my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Now, I would posit that this recognition of a spiritual reality that transcends our understanding is necessary for all true learning. That begins with a basis in a deep sense of wonder. Okay, I mean, think about it. At the end of the day, you have to believe in something that transcends you, in something that you can't fully grasp, in order to marvel at its mysteries. Right? If everything is reducible to things that we can understand, then from the start, we've undercut our ability to wonder at things, or have this sense of awe. Right? So Romans 11, 33-36, the end of this wonderful doxology at the end of Romans 11. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable His judgments and His path beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has been His counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay him? For from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. Amen. To Him be the glory forever. Amen. Okay? Furthermore, So we start with this sense of the wonder at the awareness of God and His creation. Okay. Furthermore, wisdom as the pursuit of God. Christian learning is pointed toward wisdom, not just knowledge. And we must recognize that wisdom comes from God. Proverbs 1:11, or Psalm 111:10, Proverbs 9:10, etc. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Augustine makes this point. This is an interesting passage. This is quote number 6 there on your sheet. Augustine makes this point. In the Confessions, he says this, quote, "My God, how I burned with longing to have wings to carry me back to you, away from all earthly things, although I had no idea what you would do with me. For yours is the wisdom," quoting Job. In Greek, the word philosophy means love of wisdom. Right now, if you don't know the context of this, this pretty much makes no sense. In the context, he's talking about when, Augustine is talking about when he fell in love with philosophy. And his point is that the wisdom is with God. And so in pursuing wisdom through the study of philosophy, being a lover of wisdom, Augustine, even though he didn't realize it fully, was actually pursuing God. So what we see here is Augustine saying that the ultimate telos of the enterprise of learning is found in God. Pieper explains it this way. He says, "It is not the loving search for any kind of wisdom. It is concerned with wisdom as it is possessed by God." Aristotle actually calls metaphysics, the most philosophical part of philosophy, the divine science. I talked about that at the beginning. Because it deals with a wisdom that is only fully possessed by God, end quote. Okay? So we understand that ultimately what this is about is a pursuit of God. Okay, a couple of final points. It's important to recognize that this intellectual inquiry that's done from a perspective like the one I'm arguing for here is intrinsically humble. Given that God transcends us, perfect wisdom is not attainable. Again, we don't want to fall into skepticism, but we are finite creatures with limited capacities. 1 Corinthians 1:25 says, "For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength." I referred to this earlier in passing. Look at quote number 7 there from Pieper. He says this, "Since the very beginning, philosophy has always been characterized by hope. Philosophy never claimed to be a superior form of knowledge, but on the contrary, a form of humility and restrained and conscious of this restraint and humility in relation to knowledge. The words philosopher and philosophy were coined, according to legend, and the legend is of great antiquity, by Pythagoras, in explicit contrast to the words Sophia and Sophos. No man is wise, no man knows, God alone is wise and all-knowing. At the very most, a man might call himself a lover of wisdom and a seeker after knowledge. That is to say, of course, most humbly, yours truly, a philosopher." Okay? There's a similar passage in the Phaedrus, where Plato's talking about what we should call these heroes, like Lysias, Saul, and Homer. And he says, "To call them wise, Phaedrus, seems to me too much, and proper only for a god. To call them wisdom's lovers, philosophers, or something similar would fit them much better and much more seemly." Okay? And finally here, quote number 8 there on your sheet from the Apology. Socrates argues that while he may possess some degree of human wisdom, only God is wise. Quote, "Human wisdom is worth little or nothing, and the man among you is wisest who, like Socrates, understands that his wisdom is worthless," end quote. Okay, so both scripturally and in terms of the non-Christian tradition, or aspects of it that are non-Christian, there's this sense of, everybody understands, there's this sense of humility that we should have. Our approach to learning relies to some extent on human reason. Okay? And on the truths of scriptures. And while we eschew the hubris of modernity and enlightenment, and we recognize that we're limited. That's appropriate. When we search, or when we understand our search for wisdom as a search for something that ultimately comes from God alone, we see that the final end, to use Aristotelian terminology, the final goal of all learning from a Christian perspective is to glorify God and to increase our love for and understanding of Him. This is one of the reasons why Aquinas describes philosophy as the handmaiden of theology. The proper use and study of truth, of philosophical truth, is to serve our study of the higher truth of God. To quote Pieper for the last time, from the Philosophical Acts, quote, "Philosophy implies a relation to theology. Philosophy is trained on theology, and this direction of thought toward theology is part and parcel of philosophy. The original conception of philosophy has a window open on theology," end quote. Sertor Lange, this is quote number 9 in The Intellectual Life, similarly writes, quote, "Just as no particular branch of knowledge is self-sufficient, so all branches together are not self-sufficing without the queen of knowledge, philosophy, nor the whole of human knowledge without the wisdom springing from the divine science itself, that is to say, theology," end quote. Lastly, in pursuing wisdom, which ultimately leads us to knowledge of God, we also learn about who we are as human beings. One of the dangerous things about our contemporary society's fetish with self-identity, or the self-determinations of identity, is that the source of all of that is grounded in ourselves as individuals and our own desires, our desire to be what we want to be. Whereas there's a long tradition of understanding that we understand our identity only properly when we see it in relationship to God. The final quote on your sheet there is this extended quote from Cicero. He says this: "Wisdom is the mother of all good things. The love of her gives us the word philosophy from the Greek. Of all the gifts which the immortal gods have bestowed on human life, none is richer or more abundant or more desirable. In addition to everything else, she alone taught us this most difficult lesson, namely to know ourselves, a precept of such power and significance that it was ascribed not to any mortal, but to the God of Delphi." End quote. And Cicero goes on to write that the person who knows himself will first of all realize that he possesses something divine, and he will compare his own inner nature to a kind of holy image. And we are all created imago Dei. Boethius similarly writes in his commentaries on Porphyry that, quote, "This love of wisdom is the illumination of the intelligent mind by that pure wisdom, and is a kind of return and recall to it, so that it seems at once the pursuit of wisdom, the pursuit of divinity, and the friendship of that pure mind," end quote. So again, the pursuit of wisdom is tied to a pursuit of divinity, of God. Throughout the Consolation of Philosophy, Lady Philosophy repeatedly claims that Boethius' problem is that he doesn't understand his own nature in light of the divine. That's his problem. So the always incomplete attainment of wisdom offers not only insight into the nature of God, but also into the nature of who we are as human beings. Okay, so let me conclude with this. Then we'll have a few minutes for questions before we break early for lunch. I think it's incredibly important that we as educators teach our students to develop a kind of wonder. That we, again, from kindergarten through 12th grade and beyond, and in our own lives, continue to cultivate and develop a sense of wonder, the ability to marvel at things and the complexities of and mysteries of reality in the way that we've talked about today, and the way that Plato and Pieper and Shaw and Sartre Lawrence and all these folks have talked about. Okay? I also think it's really important that we recognize that all of our teaching and our students' learning ought to be teleologically directed toward wisdom, toward a life of virtue and wisdom, and ultimately toward God. Okay? Now, I think we've all of us who work in K-12 schools have probably experienced this, that as students grow older, parents tend to focus a little bit more on the immediate goal of college entrance or lucrative careers, right? Same thing happened in college. Hence all the jokes about, you know, freshmen who come home telling their dad that they want to major in philosophy or English or art or something like that, right? As students become older, it's less easy, I think, for parents often to see the value of a classical Christian education. When kids are younger, these ideals that we talk about sound really cute. And as they get older, there's an incredible social pressure in our contemporary context to judge schools very quantitatively and by very utilitarian and immediately demonstrable results, right? And I think that's really dangerous. So I've heard a number of parents say things like, you know, I really value the God-centered education that you provide. That's great. But we're seriously considering whatever other option because we think that it will boost our child's reasons or chances to getting into the college they want to, or the scholarship that they want to, or the career that they want to, right? That, to me, is an incredibly pernicious perspective. It's a very easy one to slide into. But it's incredibly pernicious, and while it's understandable, it's toxic, okay? Because at a fundamental level, it completely misunderstands the final goal, the ultimate telos, of what everything we're about is pointed toward, which is a knowledge of, an understanding of, a worship of our Lord and Creator and God. Okay? When I hear people talking like that, it drives me nuts, right? I just want to say, like, don't you get it? Like, this is not an add-on. This is not just like, hey, we have this great Western education and we're going to tack on, you know, some scripture and try to help teach them to be nice people, right? Again, in the Western tradition, both from sacred and secular sources, there has been this understanding that the goal of education is to point us beyond ourselves, to point us toward something divine. Okay? And within a Christian context, we can never lose hold of that. That everything we do, God is not an add-on to the curriculum. Everything we do is to point our students steeped to the knowledge, love, and worship of God and a life of virtue. We need to recognize that the ultimate purpose of our entire system of education is just that. Our goal, in other words, is to make students into Christian learners or philosophers in the broad sense that I have discussed today. Thank you very much. All right, we have about 5 minutes for questions. Does anybody have a comment or a question that you'd like to throw out there? Yes, sir. I think that there can be truth that's plundered from the Egyptians, even in those contexts. I think that a lot of times, well, let me give you an example. I was teaching a graduate seminar to some PhD students at seminary, and throughout the course of the semester, we studied a number of thinkers, one of them being Nietzsche, right? And there's a lot to disagree with Nietzsche about. But as we worked through some of Nietzsche's texts, my modus operandi and how we approached this was, let's dig into the text, let's try to understand what's going on here, right? Meet him on his terms, sympathetically, and then be able to, in a position to evaluate it. And the students said something to me after we had gone through some of this. They said, you know, this is very interesting, because they said, we've heard a lot about Nietzsche in our other classes at the seminary, but we've never really dug into him or taken him seriously, right? It was always just sort of this pushed aside as wacko, or all the things that are wrong with him. And I said, when you really get into this and you really understand what he's talking about, this one student said, he's right about a whole lot of things. And I'm coming to understand what total depravity really means. He was onto something right here, but he didn't have the answer to the problem. So I think that within a Christian context, we can use even dark, negative, cynical, nihilistic thinking and writings to examine or to examine the truths about reality and hopefully glean from them the partial truth that they are expressing, but be able to do it in a context in which there is an answer and there's redemption also. Does that help? Yes, sir. The first one I would say is to challenge them to think about it. So I think that many of our students engage. I mentioned media, right? Engage in the internet or with their phone or with social media, whatever the case may be. Movies fairly uncritically. They just don't think about it, right? Especially some of those media. So getting them to think about it would be one thing that I think would be valuable. Having them read a little bit about this. The other thing is, I do know a lot of teachers. This is actually quite scary. I know a lot of teachers who do a sort of experiments, right? Like you'll do all your students will go out into the woods and meditate for an hour and pray and then write a journal entry about it or something, right? Or I know one teacher who did Monk Day, how did this go? She had all of them. They were allowed to only eat certain things, and they couldn't engage in any technology all day, and they had to spend so much time in reading and prayer. I mean, the point was kind of to replicate a day in the life of a monk, right, as it were. And then you have these students journal about it, and what's scary is how incredibly difficult this is for them, right? But it helps them sort of jolt free. It turns their eyes, as it were, from the wall of shadows for a brief second upward toward the light, like, to realize, like, there's something more. I heard a talk one time by a theology professor who said he had his students do this, and he said it's unbelievable because they can't do it, like, even for a half an hour. It's like you're ripping out their heart, like they feel completely disconnected. But here's something to think about. Throughout the history of Christianity, and other religions too, silence, solitude, and meditation are key, crucial aspects of spiritual growth and development. And if we have students that are not, or if we are not able to engage in silence, in solitude, in meditation, if we're not able to do those because we're so mediated and we're being so titillated by this, you know, continual sensationalism, I think that has very important and potentially negative ramifications on our spiritual growth too. So I mean, I don't know if that help them think about it and maybe insert some activities right into their life to help them sort of be jolted free even for brief moments and see that there's a way of engaging the world. I mean, I give the example of a green pepper, right? That's not taking something away from them, but that's giving them something very simple and having them, forcing them to spend time examining in depth something that's apparently fairly simple. Hope that helps. Any other questions? Comments? Objections, concerns. All right, well, thank you very much. Can I close us in prayer? Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this time we've been able to spend together. We thank you so much, Holy Father, for your transcendence. We thank you for creating a world around us and giving us the tools to investigate it, to learn about it, to inquire, and through those inquiries to learn more and more about you. Lord, we pray that as we go out from this place, that we would continue to help our students to understand what it means to truly marvel and wonder at the world around us that you've created and ultimately at you. And to have within us a desire, that desiderium scandi, that desire for knowledge and a longing for wisdom, with also a humble recognition that we're not there yet. Lord, we pray that as we teach and as we learn, that the goal of what we teach and learn would be a life of virtue and wisdom, and that we would point our students toward you, toward an understanding of you and a worship of you in all that we do. We thank you for the privilege that we have to be here today and to think about these things. And we ask all of this in your holy name. Amen. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful afternoon.